Welcome to The Vampire Squid, a podcast about increasing transparency and education in finance. This is your host, Alan Lee, and welcome to episode 54 of The Vampire Squid. Today we have on an awesome guest. His name is Eric Friedman, and Eric Friedman is the head of Expa Labs. And Expa Labs is a six-month incubator that works with early-stage startups that's based out of New York. So think of something like a Y Combinator, but Expa Labs is focused more on direct-to-consumer. And some of the past companies they've been associated with is Uber, Foursquare, and some of the other most successful startups out there. But today's episode is intriguing. It was really informative, and I think the information that Eric gave is immediately applicable, especially if you're interested in technology and startups, and especially coming from a finance angle. Eric gives a lot of great tips in terms of the 1%, 9%, and 90% rule. He also talks about why publishing content and putting your ideas out there into the public is so important, especially if you want to do something in the startup land or do something early stage or be a founder yourself. So I found that the episode was extremely useful. And for the first 16 minutes, we talk a little bit about Eric's background and how he got to where he is. And then from 16 minutes and onwards, we dive into sort of the meat of the episode in terms of all the tips and his knowledge that he's gained through his career in technology and entrepreneurship. So without further ado, please welcome Eric. So welcome to The Vampire Squid. I have on a very special guest today with me, Eric Friedman. Eric, thanks so much for coming on to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So Eric, you know, before we start, would you mind giving a quick background on yourself so my listeners know who they're listening to?
Not at all. So my name is Eric Friedman, and I have been working with and around early stage companies and at startups almost my entire life. Born and raised in New York. And I'm currently working at a place called Expa, which invests in early stage companies, both started by the partners at Expa and outside founders in a program I run called Expa Labs. And throughout my career, I've had an opportunity to be both on the investing side of things and the operating side of things. And this is a great hybrid of both.
Cool. And just even going back further, you know, what did you study in college and, you know, where did you sort of start your career and how did you get here?
Sure. So I got interested in computers and technology through gaming. Okay. I was a big online gamer, studied marketing in college.
What games did you business. Play?
If you hearken all the way back to before most of your listeners will probably know, before World of Warcraft, there was just Warcraft and Warcraft 2, okay. Where you could play with up to six or eight players. Warcraft 2, Tides of Darkness was a game that a bunch of people played.
Interesting.
And then which a lot of people probably still know is Counter-Strike.
Yep.
And if you remember back to those days, you had to have a pretty great gaming rig. And the motivation to get new computer parts and a better, you know, video card was had to get a job, had to pay for it myself. My parents weren't going to do it. So I needed to start working and build my own computer and have a better gaming setup. And so that's actually why I got my first job and started to get
to fund your gaming,
to fund my gaming habits. And then I played a flight simulation game, like a World War II flight sim game, which was one of the first MMO, like hundreds of people in the arena at the same time, which back in, you know, like late 90s was like pretty big deal. And so that was motivating to get a job, make some money, and buy more computer parts and put them all together. That got me interested in technology. I started working in like the IT sector and got involved in building websites and getting involved in buying domains and setting up sites for people. And actually started out doing a couple internships at some investment banks. I worked at DLJ, Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette.
That's one of the OG back in the day investment banks.
Yeah, it absolutely was. And it was a great, great lesson in what I didn't want to do. So being at DLJ, which is where, you know, JP Morgan Chase, now the building now is, which became CSFB. Great firm, great people, taught me what I didn't want to be doing, saw what the private wealth management group was up to. Also had an internship back in the day at Merrill Lynch, doing calls for a bunch of PWM desks.
Yep.
Again, great signaling of what I didn't want to be doing. But it was involved in the IT tech part of their offices, which was a lot of fun. And then when I was a senior in high school, this is around the dot-com crash time, I started to work for an internet startup and got my first foot in the door working at a small team technology-focused company, mm-hmm. Which was a great experience. Then went off to college and decided that that's what I wanted to pursue. And so coming out of college, I worked for a large advertising company thinking, hey, let me try out another big industry. I worked at Gray, part of WPP. I worked at Mediacom and a company called Beyond Interactive, which was the interactive media side of things. Also figured that's not what I wanted to be doing, but got exposed to a lot of interesting things and got recruited away to work at a startup in New York called Reprise Media that was in the search space. This was early days of search, and half the battle was to explain to someone what search marketing was, uh-huh. educate them on how it all worked, and then try and have them buy search ads. And today we talk about it almost as an afterthought of, you know, you type something into a search engine and there's so much intent there and you get an ad for exactly what you just typed.
Yeah.
But in the early days of search, that didn't exist. And so this was a startup.
Was this marketing through Google search ads or
Google search ads? Yahoo's. And okay. You know, today we say, like, you know, Google and Bing and Yahoo, like the three major players.
Yeah.
Back in 2004, we were running search campaigns across 22 different search engines. That's the long tail of how big that sector was before wow. consolidation happened. That company was bought by IPG, and so became part of another large advertising holding company, mm-hmm. and wasn't sure what I wanted to do next, and had been writing at the time, something I'll get to in a minute, my thoughts on startups and services and kicking the tires on what I thought were cool.
This is a blog or?
Writing a blog, cool. Exactly. And saw a post at Union Square Ventures where they asked for people who were interested in basically an analyst role to send their link to their web presence. And it could have been anything. Mm-hmm. Back then, it was a link to Delicious or MySpace or your LinkedIn profile or your blog.
Delicious. I'm not even familiar with that.
Great story for older listeners. One of the early companies that Union Square Ventures invested in and one of the partners formerly worked at was a tag. They basically came up with, started by a guy named Joshua Schachter, uh-huh. and it was bought by Yahoo. And it was originally what building a taxonomy and tagging hierarchy looked like. So imagine you found a series of articles about, I was listening to one of your episodes, term sheets, uh-huh. and you found six different websites. Folks today might know things like Evernote yeah. or other services. You could quickly tag and just say term sheet and everything would be tagged that way. And so that service didn't exist. And
so it was the first hashtag.
Exactly like hashtags. Exactly. and so it could be a link to anything. Uh-huh. And in my case, it was my blog. And I got an interview there. And the idea of working on the next startup after the sale and hook up with IPG was interesting, but I wasn't sure where I wanted to go. And mm-hmm. this was a great opportunity to kind of widen that aperture. Sure. I did not know a lot about venture capital, did yeah. not know a lot about early stage investing. And it was a very small, very collegial firm. I did not know a lot about that industry, but it was a great way to get exposure to a bunch of early stage companies. So at the time, it was three partners, myself and one other associate, so mm-hmm. just five people. And I was there for a couple of years. And it was just a great way to see what the early stages look like. Having a bunch of companies basically have a couple different outcomes, shutting down, being acquired, going public, yeah. or just sort of continuing along.
And Union Square Ventures is now one of the top VCs in, you know, New York. And
fantastic firm, great partners that I learned a ton from. I have a lot of respect for those guys, and have invested in a lot of the companies that you probably do know of. Mm-hmm. It's funny that Delicious isn't one of them, but was one of the early New York City tech companies that established a lot of careers and experience and operating roles for a lot of different people.
Yeah, I actually one in the beginning stages of my podcast, I interviewed someone named Charlie O'Donnell, who was
another early analyst at USV.
Yeah, I think he might have been one of the first or not
yep,
the first
that's
analysts
right.
there. And,
that's
and
right.
he said he had a great experience. And you know, I obviously follow the blog that Fred Wilson puts out on ABC and get the email updates. So
great writing, great prompt. I think it's one of the things that, that attracted us to each other is that that at the time, daily cadence, he's obviously kept up with it. My blogging has trailed off a bit as my days have been filled up. But in terms of just putting things out there, asking questions, letting people, you know, sort of challenge your assumptions of things that you write about as well. They invested in a company. We invested in a company called Foursquare. And I got to know the founders pretty well and decided to join their full-time as the first full-time BD role and was there for about 6 years. And then kind of picked my head up and looked around at what might be next. I can get more into the time at Foursquare because 6 years at a startup is a long time.
Yeah.
One of the co-founders of Foursquare, Naveen Selvadurai, is one of the partners at Expa. And so reconnected with him and came here as an EIR, which is entrepreneur in residence, for those who don't know it, at firms, kind of for folks who are figuring out what's next. This is usually a stepping stone for starting a company, potentially going down the investment track or something else altogether. And at Expa, that meant helping companies almost like a roaming COO in an operating capacity. They needed operating help, but didn't want to hire full-time. And what the partners here ended up wanting to do, they raised a second fund. They raised $100 million to deploy capital both to their ideas and their studio companies and opening the door to outside founders. And that is what Expa Labs is. And so I migrated to that role.
Yeah.
And we are, we just started our 2017 group of companies and just announced them. And it's like I mentioned before, an interesting hybrid of getting up to selecting and investing in those companies. And then transitioning to helping them. It's a 6 month program where we invest up to 500K in each company. And then they're here in our office for a while. Some companies are distributed, but again, it's a great hybrid role of what I was doing at USV and what I was doing at Foursquare.
BD at Foursquare, business development. I know it's a very broad term. Could you provide a little bit of color on, you know, what that role exactly means at Foursquare and, you know?
Absolutely. So business development is probably one of the most nebulous terms out there at startups. A lot of people want to go into that route. There's folks who are in finance or banking or an analyst role who want to pivot their career and go into BD. There's folks who want to work at a startup and have some consulting experience. They're working at one of the large consultancies and want to go into business development. And when people have that interest, I always try and tie it back to their own passion. So they say, I want to work in a startup. I'm non-technical, and I want to work in on the business side. And I said, do you want to work at a company that is a startup that's building solar arrays out in Arizona? Or do you want to work at a company that's working on, you know, an audio app in Manhattan? Both are startups. Both need partnerships. Both need operators. But both are incredibly different. And so what's more important is the things you love and want to focus on and are passionate about over, let's say, you know, just being in a business role. To get to the answer of your question, it means vastly different things at different companies. For me at Foursquare, at the time, it was a pre-revenue company, and we had a bunch of companies who wanted to do partnerships with Foursquare. For those who don't know, location-based service that at the time you could sort of digitally raise your hand, check in somewhere, and tell you, broadcast to your friends, I'm at this restaurant, I'm at this bar, I'm at this office. And there was a game mechanic behind it, one of the first pioneers of that phrase, which would reward people based on points and badges and other things. And so partnerships and business development at Foursquare was a combination of things, working with mobile phone providers and carriers to get distribution of the app, working with brands who wanted to get their logos and verbiage into the app in a branded content, almost native advertising of this reward system. And it also meant everything in between. So, at the earliest stages, I would joke with people that the real answer, there was a time, you know, I'll never forget where, the internet went out in the building and there was nobody there to call Time Warner, right? Which is now Spectrum. And I remember, you know, the engineers, if you think the time, money, hourly, every minute that ticked by, we didn't have internet, like they're not pushing code and developing the product.
Sure.
And so I just picked up the phone and figured out, social engineered my way into getting account access and getting a technician out to repair the internet. And I give those two juxtapositions because at the time it was like a phone call with, the folks at Verizon for app distribution and a huge partnership, which resulted in, like, you know, hopefully millions of downloads, to dealing with a technician because a backhoe broke the internet cable coming into the building. Yeah. And I think at the earliest stages, you've got to be willing and ready to do both of those kind of things. It's not just the big marquee deals. And throughout the time that I was there, you know, 5.5, 6 years, the role really evolved to the larger partnerships, I actually left the BD team, was the first person on the sales team. And so that was about finding and creating a actual scalable revenue plan, not just selling one-off badges and small revenue amounts. But as the company continued to raise money and focused on local search, coming up with those products and building a national sales team, a mid-market sales team, and a local sales team, and then hiring people to run those. Mm-hmm. And then a third chapter at Foursquare was actually building up the ad tech stack, which is now the focus of the company, the lion's share of revenue, something I'm really proud of called Pinpoint, which is a way to scalably target people based on foot traffic. Think about the best analogy I've got for you is Nielsen for the real world. So it's a location panel for folks like you to measure, let's say, the efficacy of ad campaigns of people going into physical stores, and also to measure what's going on at those locations and those stores through a panel that exists that is the two apps that Foursquare released, Foursquare and Swarm, as well as a ton of other apps and hundreds of millions, billions of data points to get the most accurate foot traffic patterns that exist. Mm-hmm. So for those analysts and for those finance folks out there, I'd say the V1.0 of doing this was like looking at satellite photos of parking lots outside of like a Walmart. Imagine if you could have data points that tracked how many people cross the threshold of that mall door, mm-hmm. and actually where do they go in that mall. Mm-hmm. So instead of counting cars and counting empty spots, you actually get deterministic data from phones.
And do you provide this data to the businesses? Or
they do that... now. They sell directly to hedge funds and other companies that they can use and measure that data to do what they want with.
Gotcha. And I guess through your experiences and your 6 years at Foursquare, you know, what were some of the key takeaways that you had coming out of that experience?
Yeah, there were so many. So I think the first thing is that defining that business development term there, a lot of people wanted to work in BD. When I explained to them the dichotomy of what that meant, it turned a lot of people off.
Interesting.
I think the other thing is that having essentially three different jobs there really cemented the fact that, you know, managing people, interviewing people, and talking with a lot of people, I think that one of two things happens over the span of someone's professional career. You hopefully either achieve job mastery in about, I'd call it 16 to 18 months, mm-hmm. and hopefully you're hitting your stride at that point. And one of two things happens. You are either promoted into a place where you're getting more challenged, or you start to stall out and are not being challenged as much.
Sure.
I think that's one major takeaway. That happened to me throughout that time. And if you look at that, my time there, about 18 to 24 months into each role, I sort of hit job mastery and then completely changed what I was doing. Mm-hmm. The fact that the company was growing, the fact that the market was growing, and the fact that it was super interesting to solve those challenges, yeah. is probably why I stayed. The second is that startups are not for everyone. And so that's why I try and give people the real nitty-gritty answers, because I think a lot of the glamorous headlines you see and growth of companies and 1 to 2 year, you know, success stories artificially impact people's view of what a real startup is and what that balance looks like. And then a huge amount of negotiating and hiring and different management things throughout, how to manage, you know, from what was early stage investors to what I call like mid stage investors to later stage and dealing with all the relationships.
Yeah. Involved. Let's talk about some startups, because I know with Expo, you guys work, you know, directly with a cohort of startups, you know, every year and help develop them. And, you know, my listener base is mostly in college or a couple years out of college and has an interest towards finance or is currently in finance. But I also get a lot of questions and emails about finance candidates pursuing something in tech, mm-hmm. Pursuing business development in tech, or sure. potentially doing entrepreneurship. What are your thoughts on sort of non-technical candidates pursuing entrepreneurship or doing a startup, and maybe a flavor towards specifically finance candidates?
Yeah, so there's a huge amount of those people that want to, first of all, stick to and stay in what they're doing, right? Work in finance and work up the chain and, you know, become MDs and have certain payout lifestyle and that works. There's folks that go on the management track or the consulting route, and that's totally fine. Mm-hmm. I try and persuade people to take the entrepreneur route and either join a company or start a company, but that's because far fewer of them choose to do so. It is definitely not for everyone, but I respect that move. For those that want to make the switch, I think that the thing they think about is how can my skill set be applicable to this company? Mm-hmm. But the lens they look at it through is the headlines they read. So they think of it in terms of, I could use my analyst experience and the deal making I have with these larger players, maybe like from a PE perspective, and they apply a Facebook lens to a 5-person company that's renting a WeWork space.
Got it.
And I think that's a common misconception. Hmm. And you know, something we were talking about before the show is like asking the right questions of the people you're going to be working with and for. My favorite one is, what happens here on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., which is the real answer when it's a rainy day and you've just got to deal with the internet being out or dealing with a large potential partnership. That's, I think, first and foremost. The other thing is that the cohort of people you're describing probably got in the door a different way than what is required of startups. What I mean by that is they have incredible accomplishments, you know, went to probably great schools and had great extracurricular activities and came from what I call like the institutional school problem of how to craft your resume and cover letter.
Yeah.
I described earlier my interview process for USV was submit a link to your blog or your web presence. Mm-hmm. That is not a typical way of applying for a job, right? It's putting together a great cover letter all about you and a great resume with bullets and, you know, your activities and interests. And I always say that when you send that information to a CEO and ask for, you know, their time, the disconnect is that CEO at any given time in an early stage company is dealing with 100 different fires. They're trying to raise money. They're trying to hire someone. They're trying to fire someone. They're trying to deal with a partnership. They're trying to deal with a ship date that slipped. Mm-hmm. They're trying to deal with bugs in their app. They're dealing with a customer service issue. And all of a sudden comes someone that says, here's my background. Here's what I did in high school. Here's how many languages I speak. Here's the activities and things I was involved in. Here's my school. Here's my experience at this bank. And if you look at those two personalities, you realize that the flood of emails that they get with that information, it's almost like hitting a brick wall. There's nothing they can do with it. And so what I encourage people to do is really take the time to think about the person they're about to talk to and the company and what they want to build, hopefully at a venture scale, and come up with, and this is tough for a lot of people, but putting themselves out there, and probably comes from my writing and blogging, maybe three things that the company should do. Or, hey, here's three ways that your competitors are doing things better. Or here's what I would do if I was in the role today. And if you think about that person and that CEO, and she's dealing with 100 different fires, and someone comes to you and says, hey, here's three things you could be focused on, and they agree with you, they're going to answer that email. They're going to grab coffee with you. They're going to maybe think about you for that role. Instead, what they're hit with is, here's my amazing accomplishments. And they don't know how to apply that to putting out those fires.
So sort of coming at it from the perspective where I can add value to your company.
That's exactly right.
Being, hey, I'm so great, please hire me.
But here's the trick. That works when for a big bank. That's how you stand out from the 5,000 people that are applying. The issue with the 5-person startup is they don't get 5,000 applications. In fact, they get none. And so that balance, this is why I call it the problem of the institutions. You go to your alumni job placement, you know, office at your school, and they tell you to do this. That's how you get a job at the big bank. This is how you get a job at the big consultancy. Mm-hmm. That's not how you get a job at a startup.
That's very interesting. And, you know, with finance candidates, traditionally when they do join maybe an early stage startup, their roles are typically limited to something like business operations or biz dev. Where do you see finance candidates' skill set being applied to a startup in terms of what they've learned and what they've done in a finance capacity? So what are the pros and cons of finance candidates?
Well, I think, again, the applicable skills there will be opportunities for financial modeling, putting together spreadsheets, and maybe working with some of those things in select times. But I think the idea of, like, you know, all the different cliches, rolling up your sleeves, getting your hands dirty, doing the nitty gritty work, like, all those things are true. And so I think some of those things are helpful. An example might be helping a founder put together a financial model, potentially 3 years out. Anything more than that is just really made up. There's something I think about from the investor side of things, which is what I call competency of modeling. In the startup world, I would really challenge you to find someone that's put together a three-year model that has actually come to pass. It will either be wildly inaccurate on the upside or the downside, but it's the idea of checking the box of you are competent to put together a model. And that involves, you know, OPEX and CAPEX of the people that work there and sort of modeling out the expenditures for the next 36 months. That's an opportunity where someone can flex their financial skill set, probably putting together much more complex worksheets and models in their institution. But again, those opportunities, depending on the type of business, may be few and far between. And they might not be in, asked to join those strategic conversations because hopefully someone in the management team has that capability. I think the other way they can think about it is to bring some of their institutional knowledge or what they know about to the table. So in dealing with, let's say it's, you know, fintech is a big sector that a lot of people want to hire from big banks or consultancies and have people with experience. Let's call it 2 to 3 years of operating experience there. They can say, hey, here's how it's done on the inside when X did this deal with Y, and this is what it looks like. That can be done in a full-time job capacity, or it could just be potentially a conversation. What you really got to find a way to do is make yourself indispensable so that not just that story and anecdote and small financial modeling piece fits, but you have something to do the other 90% of the time.
And for fans, candidates that are interested in pursuing entrepreneurship or, you know, joining early stage, are there sort of tests that can they can give themselves or things that they can imagine themselves to see if they would be a good fit for doing so?
I don't know if there's tests they can take. I mean, again, the nature of what these roles are is like very nebulous, and that hurts them in some ways. I think the best test they can give themselves, obviously, this is a tough prompt for your listeners, but I followed it. So, you know, the rules of participating on the web, I'm not sure if you're familiar with like the 1%, 9%, and the 90%, which goes to say, from one of the original, you know, Fred Wilson posts, like 1% create, sort of publish, 9% comment or sort of participate, maybe an upvote or a thumb up or, you know, some sort of other interaction, and 90% consume. And that probably fits, my guess, is a big portion of your audience. So, you know, if there's something like 10,000 listeners, 1% are probably the creators, 9% probably interact in some way, and 90% probably listen or just consume.
Interesting.
And my prompt to folks, and maybe to answer the question of your test, is to take the time to articulate and craft your thoughts about a sector or a category. And what I mean by that is if you're interested in, if you look at a company like Blue Apron, which just had its IPO, and you look at the logistics and market, and you rip apart the S1, and you look at all that stuff, I would challenge folks, the test is really to publish. It's to put your thoughts together and put that online. And here's the thing that's really interesting. If you don't get that email returned by that CEO about your three areas that someone can work on in that sector, and you publish it, you actually sort of kill two birds with one stone. You have intelligent thought that's online. And what I always say is it enables you to get to the interview before you get to the interview. Because what happens before every job interview? Someone goes online, they do a search for you, they try and figure out where you are, who you are, and what your thoughts are. And you put this together, it could take an hour's worth of your time. You've entered the 1% publishers. You have some coherent thoughts about a business. You might not get the job at Blue Apron, but guess what? There's a ton of companies who are nipping at their heels who are in that sector. And I guarantee you that the small 5-person startup that's working on something similar, maybe with a new spin on it, will read what you write. And the final thing I'll say along that test is maybe a little trick or a semi-hack. Again, nobody takes the opportunity, so I'll share it. Sure. Is that when you mention the names of the people at the company, the names of the companies, and the really small ones, because we live in such a interestingly, narcissistic society, everyone has Google alerts for their company. The PR teams do, the management teams do, the VCs do. Huh. So simply by writing a post about the top five food delivery preparation businesses, you will get into their inbox without emailing them, because Google Alerts will send them an alert that somebody wrote about your company. And so it's almost like a secret way of getting in front of them without actually reaching out to them. And over time, you can use that to coherently build up a book of business or a book of thoughts that hopefully help transition you. And so in some weird way, that's what I did without thinking there was a strategy behind it of just blogging, because I was sort of trapped in an agency and wanted to get my thoughts out. Like I was sort of dying to get it out.
Yeah.
But now you can think about that and do it hopefully in a smart way. So there's not quite a test, but I would implore people to think about being in their position of the CEO of that business and how you can help them, and having that founder look at the potential worker as, hey, this could be an additive person to what we're doing in our mission.
I thought those were fascinating tips and tests that you just provided. And I think that's a very great point. Putting something out there in terms of content, you know, even with my podcast and with your blog, it's very nervous in the beginning, because you're putting your thoughts out there onto the web for people to critique in your industry, your friends, your parents, for everyone to see. And there's definitely a hurdle to getting there. But, you know, I also personally believe that, you know, everyone has something of value to add, and everyone has their different experiences and could add value to someone else's life, even if it's one person or 100 people or 1,000 people. So I think that's an awesome tip.
I think you have to be willing to do that and put yourself out there. That's probably why such a low percentage of people do it.
Yeah.
If you think back to the first day that you recorded the first Vampire Squid podcast, there really was no difference between yesterday and the day you recorded it and the day you published it. Mm-hmm. And you got that first listener and started that curve, but it probably helped you along the way, right? Your first episode is probably not as good as your fifth, which is not as good as your 10th. And you start to improve over time, and it actually ends up helping you. And it's honestly a big thing I deal with early stage founders, which I think what you're defining is imposter syndrome, which people think, how can I potentially contribute, right? Mm-hmm. Who am I to write something, record something, or put something out there about another company or about a sector? And I think the thing to embrace is the fact that it's okay to be wrong. It's okay to say, I don't know. And it's okay to ask questions. And it's probably the best thing that's happened from me blogging is saying, hey, here's some extrapolation and thought process. I'd love for people to, in a nice way, of course, but against the internet, say, hey, you're wrong.
Yeah.
Here's a better way of thinking about it. And I have actually benefited from that. But you're right, that initial hurdle is the hardest thing to get over.
Yeah.
And so the nice thing is that the walls to doing that have really become a lot lower, right? With, you know, Twitter and Medium and, you know, these sort of instant blog setups you can have. LinkedIn publishing, a lot of folks maybe don't want to deal with websites and hosting, but they may have LinkedIn profiles. They have a publishing platform now, which actually probably gets a lot of reach. But you got to get over that initial, you know, imposter syndrome that you don't have anything to contribute, because I believe everyone does.
Yeah, a good piece of advice that I got when I was starting the podcast was, you know, you may not necessarily, for me being 24 years old, an expert in the finance industry, having 2 years of work experience or 3 years of work experience, but you are an expert in your own experiences. And in terms of your own experiences that you share with other people, no one has, you know, they can't say that that's wrong, because that's your experiences. And if that's something of value to people that are pursuing something similar, that was one thing that I thought was pretty helpful in terms of getting over that hump and understanding that I don't necessarily need to be, you know, Warren Buffett of finance or investing. You know, I'm a 24-year-old millennial who has gone through these experiences that I think a lot of people out there, especially in the millennial age, would be interested in learning about. So
I totally agree. And I think you can take any of those experiences and write about them. Mm-hmm. And because they're your experience, it's not about being right or wrong. It's, hey, I just used this product. Hey, I just went on this trip. Hey, I just bought this product and used it. Here's my review of it, right? Just like you tell a friend, hey, I just checked, you know, here's this new phone case, or here's this new like restaurant. You can take that same experience, write it up, put it online, get over that sort of penny gap of, you know, oh my gosh, what if I get ridiculed? And that you will be ahead of most.
With finance candidates, with the ones that pursue tech or entrepreneurship, they also consider the MBA route as sort of a precursor to maybe technology or entrepreneurship. You know, given some of the more famous ones that have been started out of business school, like a Warby Parker per se. How do you think about that dichotomy of going directly into entrepreneurship tech or going to business school, gaining those experiences, and then transitioning into tech or entrepreneurship?
That's a great question. And I think one that is really important. So I actually asked myself this question when I was thinking about, you know, when I had left the startup and sort of was figuring out what to do next. And I came up with a framework that I'd love to share that has helped a lot of people. In fact, this is a great prompt that I should probably write this up and put it on my own blog. But I've had a bunch of one-on-one conversations about it. I look at, and mainly because of Fred's writing, he sort of describes the time at USV as a practical MBA. And there's a post on it somewhere, maybe put it in the show notes. But It actually gave me a great framework because if you think about what business school is, it's, you know, a series of case studies and working groups and sort of real life examples of things. Getting to sit shotgun to a bunch of investments and board meetings, myself and the other young guy there, his name's Andrew Parker, who's now at Spark, we sort of split the portfolio and each shadowed one of the partners on that deal and got to see them through all the different life cycles. That, in my case, I look at as a practical MBA. It is by no means can't hold a candle to what is a real MBA. But what it gave me was an interesting framework that I think is helpful if someone's at a crossroads of what they should do next. And I think there's three reasons why you should get an MBA. And if you have two out of three, don't go. And so those are building a network, having direction, and sort of finishing your education. And what I mean by that is, to your point about so let me explain each of those. A network is the people you're going to be surrounded by, potential business partners, potential co-founders, right? Like the network of people that you are going to want to work in and around and with. If you have that network, that's one reason why you might not want to go to business school. Direction. So I've seen a lot of people who go from finance, say, I want to go into startups, so I'm going to go get an MBA, and then I'm going to go into startups. Or I want to start my own business, so I'm going to go figure this out. Or, you know, I want to start a business, but I went to undergrad in pre-med and I don't know anything about running a business. And so that's a great way to do it.
Yeah.
And then the final is education. So, you know, that's actually like the deep financial modeling and the education that sort of bolts on to undergraduate degrees. And in my mind, I knew what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to work in and around early stage companies. So I had that direction. I like to think I built an incredible network while I was there. Did I have that top tier, top 10 MBA level education? No, but I had the other two. And so I had those two out of three, decided not to go. And the way I thought about it is you can be out of market and $200,000 in debt for 2 years. Or if you can get those things elsewhere and save that money and get the operating experience, that's a great methodology to use. And so if you find yourself in a place where you don't know what to do, you don't have the network to do it, and you don't have the education necessary, that's three out of three. And this might make sense to look at what an MBA program could do for filling in those three gaps.
So if you do have two of the things that you would want to go to an MBA for, then you don't go.
You know, have the experience. So example would be if you have some technical experience or you have a partner you want to start a business with and an amazing network to really kickstart a business, you know, that's the network and the direction. You might not have the finishing pieces of the polish of an education, but you have two out of three. Or maybe you've been working as an analyst in finance for a long time and you have that education and you know you want to work in startups. Maybe you can bootstrap the network piece and not go to business school again, being out of market for 2 years and in a program. A lot of these places now have entrepreneurial groups and programs and different things to help you break into it. But again, in my opinion, if you have two out of those three things, don't go.
That's helpful advice because I know typically for finance candidates, that's the typical path, you know, a couple of years of banking, maybe you're working at corp dev or hedge fund or private equity, and then business school where they pursue this idea that they want to go. But no, that's very helpful advice.
I think the hardest part for most people in those positions and who choose a different path is they say, I want to work in a startup or I'm very entrepreneurial. And if you think about it, and this is more of a visual, but if you'd imagine two different paths, one is the management consulting path, and one is the early stage startup path. In the beginning, those paths are very much aligned. It's like a V. And every year that ticks by, those two paths get further and further and further apart. And what I mean by that is the network, the people you're around, right? They are risk averse. Socioeconomically, you're definitely in a different earnings potential than you are at an early stage company. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, life happens. Maybe you make some decisions, start having kids, whatever. It becomes much, much, much harder to jump across that V and get to the other path. And so the reason why I encourage people to start earlier is maybe the risk profile looks a little different in the early stages.
Yep.
So when you're starting a company or joining a consultancy, there's almost no difference. But 5 years later, when you have a house, a mortgage, and a family, and it's time to jump over to the other side and start a company, a lot of people have trouble doing that.
It only gets harder as you get more responsibilities. And that makes sense.
That's right.
And I know we were talking about this a little bit earlier before we started the interview, but joining an early stage company, a lot of people think I'm going to join this company, you know, as one of the first of 20 people, and then be there for 5-10 years and see it exit in terms of an IPO or an acquisition. But that isn't really the case with what you've seen. Can you talk a little bit about that type of experience and that mindset, or how they should be different?
Sure. I think people are embracing the fact that younger folks change jobs more often. It's just a fact. I think if you look at the average tenure of a job now, it's like something like 2 years. I think that's right.
Yeah.
You know, gone are the days of working at a factory for 40 years and getting a gold watch and getting a retirement, right? So in my opinion, embracing that fact is actually much healthier. So my point earlier, someone achieves job mastery in called 16 to 18 months, and they're really, you know, shining. You as a manager can look at that and give them an opportunity to continue to be challenged and change their role. But the reality is the people that join in the first 1 to 3 years of an early stage company mm-hmm. are vastly different than the people that join in years 4 through 6, which don't look anything like the people that join in, you know, years 7 and 8. I think you'd be hard pressed to find someone that has joined an early stage company, sub 20 people, that is the right person that's there 5 years later that's not in the management team. I think the founders and this and the C-suite are probably have a chance, but rather than try and you know, fit a square peg in a round hole, embrace that fact and have open conversations with people that say, look, this is a great stepping stone for you for the next 1 to 2 years, and ask people, kind of like I did, what do you want to do next? Where do you want to go? And actually help them hone their skill set to where they want to go. Maybe they want to start a company, be a founder. Maybe they want to go to a business school and get a bunch of experience to have that great thing for their application. Mm-hmm. Although I'll probably talk them out of it. But you know, asking those questions earlier and having healthy conversations sooner seems to fit the profile of the reality of job seekers and employees today, rather than saying, hey, we're going to be here for 10 years. Now, that's up against the fact that most early stage companies don't see a liquidity event for 8 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. So just know that the risk profile has to match that early stage salary and equity that will materialize and vest over the first few years, but that you might not see any return for you know, close to a decade. Mm-hmm. That's, of course, up against all the marquee things we read about that are, you know, this company's 3 years old and it's sold for X hundred million or billion dollars. But if you do your homework, you realize how many companies did not achieve that. And hopefully you're leveraging that work experience to get to where you want to be, like figuring out your North Star, mm-hmm. or use that experience to figure out what your North Star is. And if you have a great manager and you have a great team, it can be a great way to do that versus saying, hey, we're all going to be here for the long run for the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm. And when you say, you know, embracing that fact that the job may change in 2 years, or you might not be there in a couple of years, are you saying that from the perspective of the candidate or from the management team?
Both. So if you think about a company that is in, it's hopefully venture scale with an interesting idea, mm-hmm. and they have just started. And let's pretend it's a simple SaaS company that has 100 clients. Mm-hmm. What, according to the management team and the beliefs and the goals and the vision of what they want to do, how many company customers do they have in 3 years? The answer is not 200,
yeah.
right? It's probably exponential. It's probably 1,000 or it's 10,000 customers. That's mm-hmm. the goal, right? That's exponential growth.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at that fact, you can look around at what the engineering team looks like to support 100 customers, what the marketing team looks like to support 100 customers, what the customer service team looks like to support 100 customers. And then you can ask yourself, if we grow along the lines of the projected growth, what will each of those teams and my role look like if we had 10,000 customers? Hmm. And it would be vastly different.
Yeah.
You'd have to have a huge customer service organization. You'd have to have a different engineering organization. Probably some of the same people. But again, if you look at the growth trajectory of the companies and then what type of person can support the early stage versus where they want to go, those are two different personality types. And that's okay. And maybe that helps define a little bit more about what I mean.
Interesting.
Is that helpful?
Yeah. Because maybe someone that wants to join an early stage company likes the fast-paced growth of scaling from 10 to 100. But when it goes from, 1,000 people to a 5,000 person organization, it feels corporate.
Sure. You become a small fish in a big pond.
And that's not something they're looking for.
And those are very rare. You know, how many companies that were, five people 5 years ago are now 5,000 people?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how many there are. But again, the experience of trying is really valuable.
Got it. So I know we're running a little bit short on time, but if there's a piece of advice or something that you'd want to leave my listeners with based on your experiences at Expa and Foursquare and your past experiences, what would you want to talk to them about?
I would say the barriers to creating something, both if you have an app idea or a website idea or a business idea, the barriers to getting to a V1, a version 1, have drastically been lowered. And so what I would encourage people to do, either by scrapping together their own resources, begging a friend, taking an online course, or putting together like a mock-up or a design, even drawing it on paper, that's the first thing. Because the difference between someone that says, I have a great idea, and someone that says, I have a beta for you to test, mm-hmm. Is huge. The barrier to creating something has just become so small that I would, one, encourage people to get their first prototype done. And you can do that today without a lot of technical skill. And the second is what we already covered, which is I always encourage people to put something out there of their own thoughts, their own knowledge, and their own sort of mindset and worldview about a sector, category, or company that they're interested in, because it will help you in the long run. Mm-hmm. It might not help you in this job. It might not help you in your next job, but it'll help you two jobs from now when someone Googles your name and finds, hey, this is a smart thinker.
Yeah. Hopefully we get that 1%, 9%, 90% to maybe 2 or 3%.
I would love that. all of my writing and website lives at ericgfriedman.com. And if anybody decides to write, I would love for them to raise their hand and let me know.
Sure. And I'd be happy to include, your social profile and your online presence in my show notes. But
that'd be great.
Eric, thanks so much for coming on to the show. I had a really good time.
No problem. Thanks very much.